A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar. That's the display department. With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to episode 12 of British Invaders, the podcast all about British science fiction television, and today we are talking about The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. This is Brian from Canada.
And I'm Eamon from England.
And Xander won't be joining us this time out because he is unavailable, but Eamon has agreed to join me and take his place for this episode anyhow.
I'm standing in as Xander's stunt double.
Indeed. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the version that we will be talking about for the most part today, was a miniseries from 1981 that was put out by the BBC. It was in classic space opera style, and it was a comedy. It had lots of jokes, funny circumstances. It was definitely a comedy through and through. It was written by Douglas Adams, who originally wrote the radio series version of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and then adapted it to a television series. He also wrote The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy novels. There were several of those, and so on and so forth. The television series was in 6 35-minute episodes that were broadcast in 1981.
At the very start of the series, we meet the main character, Arthur Dent, who's a very ordinary chap, who's the sort of everyman at the centre of the story. And we start when he wakes up one morning to discover his house is about to be demolished to make way for a new bypass. And in fact, in the introduction to this podcast, you actually can hear a clip of Arthur arguing with the foreman. He then goes on to discover very quickly that his best friend, Ford Prefect, is not actually from a small town in England called Guildford, but is in fact from a small planet near Betelgeuse. And Ford tells Arthur that the Earth is about to be demolished by a fleet belonging to an alien race called Vogons. And the Earth is to be demolished to make way for an interstellar bypass. Fortunately, with Ford's help, Arthur's able to get off the planet and onto one of the Vogon ships, and the series is off and running from there. Obviously, there's a parallel between what's happening to the Earth and how the story starts with Arthur's house about to be demolished. It seems in the Hitchhiker's Guide story that the planning regulations gone mad and bureaucracy appears to be a universal problem.
And they explore that parallel in a fair bit of detail, how Arthur should have gone to check the plans beforehand at his local planning office, and how mankind should have gone to check the plans for the demolition of the Earth at Alpha Centauri, and so on and so forth. A great deal of adventure and comedy follows as Ford and Arthur are off on an adventure, and other characters come into play, and all sorts of things happen. We'll talk a little bit about that as we go. As Eamon mentioned, the central character is Arthur Dent, who is very much the everyman in the story, and he is also someone who is just a little bit out of it, where most of the things that are happening around him are concerned. One of the details that was used to good effect was that when Arthur found out about his house being demolished, he immediately went out in his dressing gown, his bathrobe, and went to argue with the foreman about that. Well, he ends up spending the entire story in this dressing gown, so he's wearing pajamas and a bathrobe, and this was played to the effect of making him be a little bit unprepared and disheveled and always just a little bit out of it. The second major character who is brought into things is Ford Prefect. And Ford Prefect is the alien who's living on Earth. He looks human, but he is in fact an alien, and he's been living on Earth for some 15 years. and still has some alien gadgetry. He found out about the Earth about to be demolished, and he's a bit of a hippie hitchhiker kind of person who decides to take Arthur with him off to do all these different things when he finally manages to leave Earth.
Two of the other characters they meet when they find their way onto another spaceship are a character called Trillian, which stood for, or short for, Tricia McMillan, who is a rather attractive young woman who is a mathematician and an astrophysicist, who was played by an actress called Sandra Dickinson in the series. She was a rather squeaky-voiced American actress who was quite popular on British television at the time. And she was also part of a reasonably well-known celebrity couple, because at the time she was married to an actor called Peter Davison, who would later go on to play the Fifth Doctor in Doctor Who. In the series, Arthur has already met Trillian at a party on Earth, and there's a suggestion of a possible romantic interest there, but she'd left the party very sort of rapidly before he had time to talk to her. And the person she'd left the party with was one of the other main characters in the series, a rather interesting fellow called Zaphod Beeblebrox, who we learn in the series is president of the universe. I don't think it's covered in much detail in the television show, but certainly in the books we find out that one of the requirements of the president is to actually be sort of a figurehead and distract attention from the real business of running the universe. And certainly, as a distraction, Zaphod Beeblebrox fits the part very well. He's particularly notable because, of course, he has two heads and three arms. And that caused some problems for the television adaptation, as we'll hear about later on. He was played by an actor called Mark Wing-Davey, who'd played Zaphod originally in the radio series. Like several of the people involved in the show, was a graduate of the Cambridge Footlights Review, which is a real sort of proving ground for British comedy.
Yes, that's right. Zaphod is sort of the ultimate freewheeling, freeloading hippie type character. And that was that worked very well. The actor was a good choice. And one of the things when they're on this other ship with Trillian and Zaphod, they introduce Marvin the Paranoid Android, who is played in the sort of classic 1980s robot costume by David Lerner, with the voice by Stephen Moore. And Marvin is constantly depressed, and this is an error in the construction. He was given a real people personality. Turning that into something in a robot, they ended up with it being a highly depressed personality. So you end up with this deep, droning, depressed voice that is also sort of a hallmark of both the radio and TV series, with Stephen Moore doing the voices in both of those. And there were some other characters that come into it as well. When they were on the ship with Marvin and Trillian and Zaphod, there was also a computer that was speaking with a voice, and the computer is called Eddie. And Eddie is sort of the opposite of Marvin. Eddie is always smiley and happy, and sort of the opposite thing gone wrong.
All the robots and computers were given genuine people personalities by the company that made them. And this was thought to actually help them get on with humans. But as we see in the series, it actually makes them very annoying, particularly in the case of the always upbeat Eddie the computer.
Yes, it has exactly the opposite effect from what was desired. There was also a character called Slarty Bartfast, who was an old character with a long white beard and a robe, almost prophet-like.
Arthur is obviously out of his depth and doesn't really know what's going on through most of the series, and he asks a lot of questions of Ford. And Ford helps him out by giving him the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy book, which gives the series its title. This is an electronic book which looks in the series like a very chunky PDA, and it acts as a travel guide to the universe. And the book will go on to describe some of the aliens that Arthur and Ford will encounter and some of the situations that they'll find themselves in. And we also learn that Ford was actually a researcher for this travel guide. The other function of the book in the series is that it acts as a narrator, and it often tells us what's going on. And this obviously came from the radio show, where they needed a narrator to fill in parts of the action and the story. And by doing so in the series, that the Hitchhiker's Guide book actually in itself becomes a character in the series.
That's right. The guide is very much in the foreground and is a major character in the series. The voice of the guide was done by Peter Jones, and it was done very well. It is not simply a dry narration, but it has lots of character to it and lots of humor. Peter Jones brought a definite personality to that, and he did the same voice in the radio series as well.
He was Peter Jones was quite well-known radio personality at the time. And in particular, he'd been on a very long-running BBC radio series called Just a Minute, which is still going to this day and has an amazing reputation for being really quite hilarious. And when they were trying to cast the radio series and looking for somebody to do the voice of the book, the producers at the time said, "We need somebody with a voice like Peter Jones." And they tried various people, including, I think, some of the Monty Python actors were auditioned for the role, before eventually saying, "Well, why don't we ask Peter Jones himself?" And, of course, they did, and he said yes. And he certainly is a big part of the success of the Hitchhiker's Guide story, not least because the guide itself is very funny. His voice and the witty graphics that accompanied it on screen tell the story, fill in the gaps, and really just contribute to the humor of the whole series.
Yes, the sense of comic timing that Jones brought to it, and also the sense of comic timing that the actual graphics had, were very strong and brought a lot of humor to it.
It was certainly something that we hadn't seen anything like it before on television at that time. It was very new.
Yes, the presentation of the guide visually and the combination of the visual and the narration was quite unique. It worked very well. What they did is they had a series of animations that were usually multi-element. The animation on screen would include usually at least one picture, sometimes multiple pictures, and new pictures would appear and pictures would disappear and so on, and some text. And the text was sometimes the same text as the narration you were hearing, but it would always be a little bit out of sync. The narration would be a couple of beats ahead or a couple of beats behind, deliberately. There would also be text, sometimes more than one field of text at the same time, that would give you other information, sometimes humorous, sometimes sort of quasi-technical details, sometimes a mixture of the two. So you had what you could argue was a new type of storytelling. Very often, they would take something that was fairly dry in the narration and add something that was quite funny to it in the visuals. For example, they'd mention something about how people always repeat obvious things like, "My, you're tall," or, "So this is it, we're going to die." And the visuals would show, you know, for "My, you're tall," someone looking up at a 50-foot dragon. And for "So this is it, we're going to die," someone with 5 guns pointed at his head, and so on and so forth. It was definitely a highlight of how things were done in this series.
And quite interestingly, watching it now, the guide, there's an awful lot of information presented by the guide. And at the time when it was first broadcast, when video recorders were not all that common, it must have been very difficult to pick up all that information. I mean, now we can pause and rewind and find that there's actually lots of extra jokes and throwaway lines included in the guide, which we probably missed the first time we watched it.
On this particular Thursday, things were moving through the ionosphere many miles above the surface of the planet. Several huge, yellow, slab-like somethings, huge as office blocks, silent as birds, they hung in the air exactly the same way that bricks don't.
The planet was almost totally oblivious of their presence. They went unnoticed at Goonhilly, they passed over Cape Canaveral without a blip, and Woomera and Jodrell Bank looked straight through them. Which was a pity, because it was exactly the sort of thing they'd been looking for all these years. Arthur Dent, too, had other things on his mind.
So going a bit more into the story of things, as we had mentioned, Arthur and Ford escaped the destruction of the Earth on the Vogon Constructor fleet, which is about to destroy the Earth, and the Earth is in fact destroyed. They went to efforts, it seemed, to show the destruction of the Earth as many times as they could throughout the series. I believe it shows up in every episode except one. So the Earth is destroyed, and Arthur and Ford are on board the Vogon Constructor fleet, and they are captured by the Vogons, who threaten them with reading Vogon poetry to them, which is a form of torture, it seems, and threaten to throw them out an airlock. And in fact, they do throw them out an airlock. One of the episodes ends with Ford and Arthur being thrown out an airlock. The following episode starts with a ship called the Heart of Gold, with Zaphod and Trillian, as we've already described, on board, showing up and rescuing Ford and Arthur, which was very improbable indeed. And in fact, the Heart of Gold employs an infinite improbability drive, which, while it's running, makes it travel basically instantaneous to anywhere it wants to go, and also makes extremely improbable things happen. And there's a wonderful involved graphical sequence with all kinds of bizarre things happening to Ford and Arthur. And in fact, the ship picked them up on its own. It wasn't even Zaphod and Trillian who picked them up. And there is then the introduction of a planet called Magrathea that they're chasing after, and they finally find Magrathea, which is a mythical planet whose industry had been creating new designer planets for the very rich.
It's not quite made clear, I think, in the series why Zaphod is after Magrathea, other than that he seems to find it just a cool place to go, and we get the impression that Zaphod does things because he thinks they are cool. As you've said, he's a very laid-back, hippie-ish character and quite outlandish. But they do, in fact, find Magrathea, and after a rather bizarre scene that involves the famous creation of a bowl of petunias and a very large whale in the atmosphere above the planet, they manage to land successfully on Magrathea, which is where they meet another strange character who you've already mentioned, Slarty Bartfast, a character that Douglas Adams decided to try and find the strangest and rudest sounding name he could for. He takes Arthur away and starts to explain some of what's been going on, and so that Arthur and ourselves get an idea of what's been happening all along and why Magrathea, this mythical planet which made designer planets for the galactic rich, has been woken out of hibernation to start producing one special project again. We learn a bit more about the nature of the Earth itself, and in particular, we learn about why some little white mice were so upset about its destruction. And all this is leading us, of course, towards the answer, the big answer that everybody was looking for, which was the answer to life, the universe, and everything.
And also leads to the fact that humans are, in fact, the third most intelligent creatures on Earth, the second being dolphins and the first being mice. What happens with the mice and what the mice are doing is a very important part indeed.
One of the main distinguishing features about The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy as an example of British science fiction is its humour. It is just a very funny series. Douglas Adams studied English literature at university, but I think he must have had an interest in science. And he certainly he knew a lot about popular science at the time, because the series is just littered with science in jokes. Later on in the series, we'll come across all sorts of time travel paradoxes, which he has a great deal of fun with, and the guy describes at length. And it's just, watching it again now, it is still just a very funny show. There's jokes coming thick and fast, there's snappy one-liners. I'm sure everybody has got their favourite lines from the Hitchhiker's Guide, I particularly like in the first episode when, after arriving on the Vogon ship, Arthur is asked by Ford how he feels, and Arthur gives the answer that he feels like a military academy. Bits of him keep passing out. Ford also goes on to describe hyperspace travel, and I always remember that he describes it as unpleasantly like being drunk, to which Arthur asks, what's so unpleasant about being drunk? And Ford tells him to ask a glass of water, which is just a great line. And of course, the series builds up to one of the, I think it's probably the most famous punchline in the history of science fiction comedy, which is when they actually learn the answer to life, the universe, and everything.
Yes, the humor really is a very important part, and it was very well done. It's a sort of absurdist humor. There is also, as an additional element of the humor, an element of philosophy that comes up, which is sort of based on the idea that humanity doesn't really understand what's going on. And one of the ways that Earth is described is that it's a place where people still think digital watches are a pretty neat idea. That's a little bit dated, maybe, but that was part of his way of looking at things.
I'm not sure what the series did for the sales of digital watches in the 1980s. It certainly made me reconsider mine, which I've been quite pleased with up until then.
For that matter, what did it do for the sales of towels? One of the elements of Hitchhikers is that your most important possession that you must keep on you at all times is a towel. And there are all sorts of things like this in it that have this way of looking at things that's just a little bit different, and that was something that I always enjoyed. The Vogon ships float in the air in just the way that bricks don't. And as far as things being mentioned about science, I believe Douglas Adams did have an interest in science, and he had considered at one point going into theoretical physics as a career, and also considered acting in the comedy line.
Right. He turns up in one or two Monty Python sketches, I believe, at his early attempts at acting.
The television version of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, before it was started, it was considered to be unfilmable. It was written for radio. The radio version did precede the books. It did a lot of things that people thought you just couldn't transfer to television. You just couldn't make this work. Early on, they actually considered making an animated version rather than a live-action version. And this was something that may have been interesting, but it was indeed very ambitious, and for the execution of it, it was pulled off very well. It actually won a Royal Television Society Award as Most Original Program of 1981, and it won a number of BAFTA awards for its graphics and editing. It was directed and produced by Alan J. Bell.
Alan Bell, in fact, he was one of the people who felt it couldn't be done originally, but decided that it should eventually be done in the live version, and did a very good job of it. He was interesting because he was mostly known before The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy for producing short music films for a British music show called Top of the Pops, which is quite interesting and a parallel to when we get on to the people who eventually made the movie. He directed and produced the series for the BBC, although he only gets a production credit, I believe, because the BBC had some strange rule at the time that you were only allowed one credit per person in the end credits. He was also, I think, helped by John Lloyd, who executive produced the series, who'd been quite a long-term collaborator with Douglas Adams since they were at Cambridge together. And they wrote together in sketches before The Hitchhiker's Guide. And they went on to write books together after The Hitchhiker's Guide.
And John Lloyd actually co-wrote a couple of the original episodes of the radio series for Hitchhikers with Douglas Adams. And he doesn't have a writing credit on the TV version, only on those two episodes of the radio version. They actually restructured the end of the TV version in order to not use the material that was co-written by John Lloyd.
One of the problems they'd had in bringing it to the television was, of course, the narration on the radio show. And as we've heard, they managed to fill that gap by using the guide, the book itself, as a character. And so we've got lots of animation going on the screen, which can fill in some of the plot for us, and also can occupy us and the screen when perhaps the characters aren't doing very much in the story. So we get this sort of switch in from live action to the animated elements of the guide itself.
Yes, it keeps things very well punctuated. You're never looking at the guide entry for too long, and you're never looking at the live action portions for too long, although it is longer than the guide entries. The way that they actually did the guide entries in terms of the graphics was quite interesting, because it was entirely hand animated, but it was hand animated in such a way that it should look like computer graphics. So they didn't use the normal backlighting way of filming hand animation. They instead used a rear projection technique that gave you something that looked more like computer graphics. It had many line drawings that were much like the basic computer graphics that you had in the 1980s. And it really gave you the look of something that was on a computer, that would be displayed on a computer. That was done by Rod Lord of Pierce Animation Studios. And it was something that was really done quite well, I think. It gave you something that had a very dynamic and new look to it. In fact, there were a number of people from computer-oriented organizations and computer-oriented publications who contacted the production company, contacted the BBC and various people involved to ask them what they used to do the computer graphics, what kind of computer, what kind of software, what did they do this. In fact, there was no computer work, and it was done by hand to look like computer work.
The graphics were just fantastic. I mean, I know everybody at the time was convinced they were computer graphics, and we were all trying to replicate them ourselves. There was a very popular home computer which had just been launched called the ZX Spectrum, which was a very low-spec home computer at the time, quite popular in England. And we were all desperately trying to recreate computer graphics like we'd seen on The Hitchhiker's Guide.
And it couldn't be done, could it?
It couldn't be done, no. And also, if you're a fan of a television show called Spaced, you may remember from the very first episode, there's a quite nice tribute or homage to the Hitchhiker's Guide animation.
Where the hell are we?
Well, I hardly like to say this, but it looks like the seafront at South End.
God, I'm relieved to hear you say that.
Why?
I thought I must be going mad.
Perhaps you are. Perhaps you only thought I said that.
Well, did you or didn't you?
I think so.
Perhaps we're both going mad.
Nice day for it. Sun.
See?
You know, if this is Southend, there's something very odd about it.
What, you mean the way the sea stays steady as a rock? And the buildings keep washing up and down?
What's that?
I don't know. Sounded like a measurement of probability.
What does it mean?
I don't know. But I definitely think we're on some kind of spaceship.
Then I can only assume we're not in the first-class compartment. Southend seems to be melting away. The stars are swirling. A dust bowl. Snow. My legs drifting off into the sunset. My left arm's disappeared. How am I going to operate my digital watch now?
How am I going to operate my digital watch now?
Ford, you're turning into a penguin. Stop it.
One of the other distinctive features of the production were the costumes, which were also very impressive. We've already heard about Arthur Dent's famous dressing gown, which he wears throughout the series and has become a very famous item of clothing. We see him at various points in the series in the background pulling items out of the pockets, which is always very interesting as to what he'd brought with him from the Earth. And I think Simon Jones, the actor who played Arthur, still owns the dressing gown, or at least owned it up until very recently.
I think he may still have it.
And certainly the look of Arthur Dent is in the distinctive Marks and Spencer's dressing gown and his pyjamas throughout the whole show.
If you ever see another show or another program that has someone wearing a dressing gown or a bathrobe while being out and having adventures somewhere, that's what they're getting at. That's almost certainly a reference to The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
There's a far more traditional science fiction outfits worn by Trillian on the spaceship The Heart of Gold. Very much going along with the idea that science fiction, television and movies mean very tight-fitting, shiny costumes for women. And the Hitchhiker's Guide is no exception by putting Trillian in a variety of shiny red outfits, which are all basic variations on a theme. And then, of course, we have an outlandish costume worn by Zaphod Beeblebrox with his two heads and his three arms and the various problems that caused for the production team. And Marvin, a delightful BBC robot, a man in a tin suit. But he looks very good, and of course his voice just steals the show in a way. Stephen Moore's fantastic performance as a depressive robot.
Ford Prefect, who was the alien who had lived on Earth for 15 years, was wearing this great combination of things that you could easily find somewhere in a store in England, but completely mismatched. So he's wearing a sweater and a jacket and pants that are all in different patterns and different styles and completely oddball, mismatched types of things.
And the actor who played Ford Prefect in the series, David Dixon, one of the reasons they cast him was because they thought he looked unusual and had unusual piercing eyes. But they also got him to wear some rather purple, bluish contact lenses to make his eyes even more distinctive and alien-looking. Although I think watching again, you can see that the contact lenses were obviously causing the actor some trouble in some scenes because there's a fair amount of blinking in occasionally.
That's true, but that did give you that slightly off, slightly alien feel to the character. The chemistry between David Dixon as Ford and Simon Jones and Arthur was very well done. It really worked very well. They were sort of perfect for those roles. In fact, Douglas Adams originally wrote the character of Arthur Dent with Simon Jones in mind. And on the whole, the acting and all of the characters really work very well. There is some controversy about Trillian, about the high-voiced blonde, and, you know, is she sort of ditzy or is she not ditzy? Is she true to the character from the radio and the novels and so on and so forth? Certainly, I think all of the other characters are really solid and the actors are good in their roles.
Yes, I think, you know, the BBC acting throughout was pretty good, and there aren't many times when you think, oh, that was a bit, that performance was slightly off. I mean, at the time, it included lots of very familiar faces and voices from television and radio in the UK at the time. I particularly like when Richard Vernon shows up as the character we've already mentioned, Slarty Bartfast, and I think that's a very nice role as this distinctive, as you describe him, prophet-like character who is obsessed with the coastlines of Norway that he designed for the Earth. There's also a very nice turn towards the end of the series by another very well-known actor at the time called Colin Jeavons, who turns up as the MC in the restaurant at the end of the universe, and quite clearly has based his performance on I think a very famous Oscar-winning performance by Joel Grey in the film Cabaret, where he plays the MC there.
There was also a big bodyguard-type character who shows up, and lo and behold, it was David Prowse, the body of Darth Vader from Star Wars. Peter Davison, who had not yet started his role starring in Doctor Who, but had been announced in that role. They actually, I think partially because of that, obscured his appearance with makeup a fair bit. He actually played the dish of the day. In the later part of the story, they were in the restaurant at the end of the universe. The restaurant is constructed at a time shortly before the end of the universe, when the whole universe is destroyed. And one of the very fancy exclusive things they have in this restaurant is the dish of the day, who is sort of a cross between a cow and a pig, but is sentient and can talk to you like a person. And apparently it's okay to eat the dish of the day because he's inviting you to eat him after he goes and shoots himself. And there's a conversation between the main character and the dish of the day.
And of course it prompts Arthur to order a green salad, which I think we share some sympathies with him at that point in the show.
You also had Valentin Dial show up as a voice, and he was, I guess, in the 70s and 80s, he was the British equivalent of James Earl Jones in terms of being the big imposing voice that was used on all sorts of things. He showed up in Doctor Who and Blake 7 and Sapphire and Steel and all sorts of things.
He's becoming a bit of a British Invaders regular, Valentin Dial.
So it seems. One of the other things that came into Hitchhikers is how they did Zaphod. Zaphod Beeblebrox was written as a character with three arms and two heads, and that was more or less a throwaway joke in the radio series. It was something that was written for radio, so there was the question of how are they going to implement this on TV. What they had done in a couple of stage versions was the sort of pantomime solution where you had a costume that would have two people in it. They did, in fact, use that pantomime solution for the third arm in many scenes, and in other scenes the third arm was just a rubber arm that was tucked into Zaphod's pocket. But the second head perhaps was a different matter. They actually built an animatronic head. They had a little model head that was sitting on the actor's shoulder that had little remote-controlled moving parts for the mouth and the eyes and so on. And that was something that was very distinctive and sophisticated for the time, to actually have something that worked that way. There was a science and technology show on the BBC at the time called Tomorrow's World, and they actually did a segment before Hitchhikers aired where they demonstrated this head and talked about how it worked, because it was a big deal at the time. However, it didn't work that well. The animatronics were not very reliable, and they ended up leaving it just sitting there and not doing anything for most of the time. The second head for Zaphod Beeblebrox was a little weak, for sure.
Yes, at the time it didn't seem to be too much of a problem. I think we just accepted it and found it quite, you know, part of the show and the story. But watching it now, although, as you say, it was clearly cutting edge at the time, looking back on it now, it does seem to be a bit weak. The sets for the series were quite good as well. Some of the model work for the exterior shots of spaceships now looks a bit dated, but I think the interiors were quite nicely done. I think the BBC had got pretty good at doing spaceship interiors with all the years of Doctor Who and Blake 7 and so on. And interestingly, parts of the Vogon ship especially were, I think they were recycled parts from the movie Alien.
The background paintings and the sets and the like were definitely a cut-up from the other British shows from that period of time.
They were pretty pleased with their exploding Earth shots because they used it about five times through the series.
I think that brings us to the end of the first half of our discussion of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and we will come back and talk about this a little bit more on the next episode of British Invaders. So for now, this is Brian from Canada signing off.
And this is Eamon from England saying goodbye.